From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. He was Mr. Orange in Reservoir Dogs. In Pulp Fiction, he held up a restaurant only to get outdone by one of the diners who happened to be a hitman. Now Tim Roth is a villain in a powdered wig showing off his swordplay in the new historical romance Rob Roy. We'll meet Tim Roth on today's Fresh Air. Also, a controversial documentary about Germany's neo-Nazi movement has been hailed as one of the best statements against fascism. It's also been criticized as Nazi propaganda. We'll talk with the director. And music critic Milo Miles remembers two people from the music world recently murdered: Mexican-American music star Selena and a producer of Algerian Rai music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I love you, pumpkin.
I love you, honey bunny.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
That's my guest Tim Roth, holding up a coffee shop in Pulp Fiction. It was his second film with Quentin Tarantino. In Reservoir Dogs, Roth was the cop who goes undercover on a bungled heist and gets shot. Roth doesn't just specialize in contemporary mayhem. He played Vincent van Gogh in Robert Altman's Vincent and Theo, and he co-starred with Gary Oldman in Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. Now you can see him in a powdered wig showing off his swordsmanship in the historical romantic adventure Rob Roy. Liam Neeson stars as Robert Roy MacGregor, the 18th century folk hero of the Scottish Highlands. MacGregor is poor but strong and courageous, ready to defend the honor of his clan and his family. And after he borrows money from the Marquis of Montrose, he has to defend his clan against the Marquis's henchman, played by Tim Roth. Roth's character is a fop and sociopathic killer. I asked Roth how he got the part.
Well, I knew that at some point I was going to have to do a studio film because you have to pay the rent. And it was a matter of reading what was out there, which was not too hot, really. It's very different from the independent film. So I'd read a few, and then Michael, Caton Jones, the director, who's an old drinking friend, really, said, phoned me up and said, look, I've got the green light on the film, and but it's happening really quickly. I'm going to send you the script. Tell me what you think. And so I read it, and it made me giggle, made me laugh.
But it's funny, you know, Liam Neeson represents swarthy, righteous manhood. And, of course, you're crazy and you're a fop. So did you feel you were really playing off this, like, swarthy manhood of Liam Neeson?
Yeah, I mean, it's the tough job. Liam has the tough job. He's got the film kind of hangs off him. He's got the nobility to deal with. He's got all that stuff to deal with. And we can come in, you know, me and John Hurt and Brian Coxon can camp it up a storm. You know, the bank isn't on us. And that, I think, is the tough job in the studio films, is that there's always somebody who has to carry it. You know, he and Jessica, I suppose, have to.
So did you have to learn sword play?
Yeah, but you do that in a... We had about 3 months, and I would, whenever I wasn't filming, I would be doing classes, and you just learn it like you would a dance. You learn it step by step.
There's a rape scene in the film in which your character is particularly despicable. Do you want to talk at all about playing that scene?
Yeah, it was you get up in the morning and say, what have I got to do today? Well, I'm going to go and rape Jessica Lange all day today. So you go in, you know, and it's not a love scene, so it doesn't require any of those kinds of passions. And it was logistics, unfortunately. It's not that exciting to talk about, apart from the fact that there's someone under the table holding it because it's moving across the floor, and there's I should explain it, it's done over a table from the rear. But it's so there's a guy trying to brace the table. There's a whole crew in there. There's a guy in the corner having a cheese sandwich. You know, it's very... We laughed pretty much in between every take. We giggled because it was just such a ridiculous situation. You know, but I think that the point was to get it to be as vile as rape is. You know, I think we succeeded to a certain extent.
Tim Roth is my guest, and he co-stars in the new film Rob Roy. You were in Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. How did you first meet Quentin Tarantino?
Well, it's the same thing. You know, your agent sends you a script, you read it, and we with that one, I was reaching for the phone, you know, after the second page, because I thought it was hilarious and, you know, beautiful dialogue. I love the dialogue with Reservoir Dogs. So I, you know, I went and met him, and then, you know, it was an audition process and trying to get the job.
Harvey Keitel was probably already a part of the project when you signed on, because I think he was even one of the producers or backers or something, but I know he was in on it from early on. Did you want to work with him? Were you already an admirer of his?
I've always been a fan. I think he's one of the great actors, American actors, and I had grown up on films like Fingers and Taxi Driver and Mean Streets and, you know, these films, and The Duelists. So, I was a big, big fan. I was very nervous to meet him.
What was your first meeting with him like?
Well, he was trying to get me to read, and I was refusing to read.
Why didn't you want to read for the part?
I get really embarrassed by reading. I'm very bad at it.
You get embarrassed by it?
Yeah, I get really... I'm very, very bad at the auditioning process, and the way I look at it is that that I will lose as many jobs by reading as I will by not reading. So it's a 50-50 thing, and I decided not to do it. But eventually Quentin, you know, we went out and got drunk, and Quentin got me to read every character in the script, but that was at a later date. But first meeting with Harvey was that he was saying, look, I really want you to read, and just to get an idea. It doesn't have to be a great audition, blah, blah, blah. But I refused to do it at that point. So that was my first meeting with him. So not only was I in awe of him, but I was turning down one of his requests.
So you read every character in the script. How did you end up being Mr. Orange?
That was the one that I wanted to do. Quentin had thought of me for Pink or Blonde, and at that stage, in the early stages, but I liked the idea of lying. Not only was I an Englishman playing an American, but in the film I was somebody pretending to be something else. And
right, because in the film you're an undercover cop who's pretending to actually be a criminal, you know, who's in on the heist. And even, like, as you die through the movie, you have to remain in character as a gangster and not a cop. And there's this great scene early on, right after your shot. Harvey Keitel is driving you to the hideout, and you're kind of bleeding to death in the back seat. Mm-hmm. And you're whimpering, going, I'm dying, I'm dying. And Keitel is trying to reassure you and trying to get you to get a hold of yourself.
I'm going to die! I'm going to die! I'm going to die, I know it!
Oh, excuse me, I didn't realize you had a degree in medicine. Are you a doctor? Are you a doctor? Answer me, please. Are you a doctor?
Huh? No, I'm not.
Okay. So you admit you don't know what you're talking about. So, if you're through giving me your amateur opinion, slide back and listen to the news. I'm taking you back to the rendezvous. Joe's gonna get you a doctor. The doctor's gonna fix you up. And you're gonna be okay. Now say it. You're gonna be okay. You're gonna be okay! Say the damn words! You're gonna be okay!
Oh, God!
Say the damn words! Say it!
I'm okay, Larry.
Your voice is great in this scene. It's this falsetto.
Yeah.
Tell me about hitting the right voice for this.
Well, with that sequence, Harvey really likes to rehearse everything. And so does Quentin, for that matter. I really don't like rehearsal for film. But so that was the only scene that I insisted that we didn't rehearse, because I actually didn't know what I was going to do. And so what you see there is what we did when the camera first started rolling, and it was just what came out of my mouth. I had no idea what to do. And that was spontaneous.
Was Reservoir Dogs the first film that you played with an American accent?
No, I'd done a film called Jumpin' at the Boneyard up in New York, which came and went, unfortunately. It's a good film about two kids in the Bronx up there.
Do you have any reservations about doing an American accent? Were you confident that you could do it?
Well, it's just a lot of homework to try and do it accurately and not slip across the water. You know, it's a lot of homework to do. On top of trying to build a character, you have to hide behind a voice in a way, and it can get in the way. Initially it always does. In the first 2 weeks of filming, it can be, you're more self-conscious than you should be, and then you start to forget about it, you know. But it's a long process. I work with a dialect coach. The woman actually that I killed in Reservoir Dogs is my dialect coach.
Oh, that's funny.
I wanted to kill her, so I got her the job.
Well, where did she start with you?
We start 3 weeks beforehand with a. She breaks the script down into syllables, into just sounds, and then we work over and over and over again, just on those lists. And then you do. Then you start working from the script, doing the scenes, and then she's on set every day when I'm filming, every night or day, whatever. And then we also work in the looping, so revoicing the film afterwards. So if there's any mistakes, you can cover your tracks there.
Now, in Pulp Fiction, you were cast as the small-time crook, the wannabe, mm-hmm. who holds up the diner, only to find out in the last scene that some of the customers are professional hitmen.
Yeah.
As played by John Travolta and Samuel Jackson. Now, did you choose that role, or were you just... Is that the role that you were offered?
No, Quentin wrote it for me. He wrote it for me and Amanda to play.
Uh-huh.
And I'd introduced him to Amanda at a premiere of one of her films, Fisher King. And I said, I want to work with her. I just finished a student film with her. And I said, I want to work with her in one of your films, but she has to have a big gun. He said, okay. And he went off and wrote it. And that's what he came up with.
So you've had to learn how to use a gun well and badly for mm-hmm. films that you've been in. How do you learn how to use it for a film?
Well, I tend to not like penis extension gun movies. So I like to look for a way to use it which is not overtly macho,
mm-hmm.
unless that's the character, which can be also fun to play with. But I don't know. You see too many guns in movies nowadays, especially after Quentin. I mean, the scripts that I'm getting now are very sort of, you know, five guys sitting in a cafe where they're wearing black suits and they're discussing Reservoir Dogs, and you know, it can get a little tedious after a while. I think they should bring back sword movies, drive-by swordings.
Well, they just did, I understand.
I know,
you're in it, right.
But drive-by sword play, you can't do it. They should bring back swords. Ban guns, bring back swords.
My guest is Tim Roth. He co-stars in the new film, Rob Roy. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Tim Roth. How did you start acting?
I auditioned for a school play as a joke, and it backfired, and I got the part, so I had to do it. And once I'd stepped out on stage, I just thought, this is the greatest thing to do. This is such fun.
So what was the part you got?
I got to play Dracula in a musical of Dracula. So it's something me and Gary Oldman have in common.
Yes, that's right. Of course, in Coppola's Dracula. Yeah. So you had to sing too, huh?
I had to sing, dance, you know.
A singing and dancing Dracula. What kind of Dracula songs did you have?
I can't remember. It's so silly. It's one of those school plays that you do, which has a large cast, so a lot of kids can get involved in it, and it was fun. It was really good fun.
So you liked it? You liked being on stage?
Yeah, it terrified me at the beginning, but I really liked it. I loved it. It's purely selfish. It's not for any of sort of isn't it wonderful to entertain people reasons. It is good for me. I like doing it. It makes me feel good, you know.
Did you start pursuing acting after that?
Yeah, immediately. I went to art school in the meantime because I already had a place in art school and I studied sculpture. But I quit that pretty quickly. I was always off anyway, doing a play here or there. So I immediately started to pursue. I didn't want to stop from then on, and it's been the same ever since.
Did you ever do the Royal Shakespeare Company thing?
No, they never invited me.
Uh-huh.
I was always doing sort of gritty, realistic drama, I suppose, over there on TV or whatever, and they never saw me as Iago or whatever it may be. Unfortunately, that's the part I would love to play, Iago, Richard III or Iago, I think.
So have you ever done Shakespeare?
I did once on the Fringe in London. I played Cassio.
Have you done less Shakespeare than any successful British actor in history?
Probably, yeah. I got to do a little bit when we did Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead. There was some Shakespeare in that, and it took me 25 takes to get it right. It was a nerve-wracking experience.
So what movies did you love when you were growing up?
I think I was really influenced by early American movies. Not early American, 70s American movies. And also Kubrick and Truffaut, I suppose.
So when you say 70s movies, with Scorsese's
early stuff. And French Connection, films like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those kinds of things. Where they were... I mean, Scarecrow is a great movie. I always loved Scarecrow with Hackman and Pacino. And Dog Day Afternoon, things like that. Wonderful.
So when you were in England admiring all these American films starring great American character actors, did you see yourself ever taking the kind of role that American character actors got?
No, I never did. It just seemed so far away to come to America. I'd never been out of the country, you know. To come to America and be in movies was just, you know, a pipe dream. It just seemed the impossible thing to do. And then as I started to work in England more and get some notoriety, I suppose, Gary Oldman took off. He went off and did a film called State of Grace up in New York and played an American and did it very successfully. And I thought, well, it is quite possible, really. I mean, if you can take the plunge, if you get invited out there to do a film, that's when it's possible, you know. So you, and I always thought, don't ever go until you're invited, otherwise you'll just end up being a bartender.
So did you wait until you were invited?
Yeah, I got lucky. I got to go to New York and make that film.
State of Grace?
Mm-mm.
Which film?
Jumping at the Boneyard.
At the Boneyard. Oh.
It came and went so quickly it created a vacuum. but it was a great, you know, sort of realism piece, and I got to play somebody from the Bronx. I got to sort of test the waters. And then I thought, well, I'll go to L.A. and do a bunch of meetings before I go back to London. And I stayed. I thought, well, I go back to London, go back to unemployment. What's the point? So I stayed and got Reservoir Dogs.
Oh.
It was a weird circle.
Uh-huh. So you really weren't too well established at the time of Reservoir Dogs?
Only at home, not here. I mean, hardly anyone saw Vincent and Theo. You know, nobody saw Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. There'd been a bunch of television films that I'd done at home. I'd worked with Mike Lee, I'd worked with Stephen Frears, I'd worked with quite a few people, but nothing that had been really seen out here. So apart from by filmmakers had seen my stuff. So that was where I had at least a foot in the door somehow.
Did you study acting?
I never did, no. I just went for it. As soon as I knew that I wanted to do it, I didn't want to stop doing it. I wanted to be, you know, go out on stage and do it immediately, as opposed to go to school and study it and then go out on stage. You know, I think if I'd have gone to school, I wouldn't have been an actor, actually.
Why?
I was the same when I was at school, like, you know, in normal school. As soon as I was told to do something, I didn't want to do it. As soon as I had to do homework, I didn't want to do it. It's only now that I can do homework because I choose to. And I think if I'd have gone to drama school and they said, okay, tomorrow we're going to be start working on Shakespeare, I would have been bored.
So you,
it's a question of, I guess, rebelling against it, even if it's in your best interest. You know.
So when you were in school, did you have trouble in school?
I was the bullied. I was the one that was pursued. And basically I hid for about 5 years until it was all over, until all the bullies left. You know, they're probably all in prison now.
What,
I hope.
What were the good places to hide?
Well, you just leave. I wouldn't be there. You know, and luckily enough, the punk thing was happening at when I was about 14 or 15, so we'd head into the West End of London and go to alternative record stores and sort of jump up and down and look silly.
You must get, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of ironic, I suppose, that you should learn sword fighting and gunplay for movie roles when you had to hide to protect yourself when you were in school.
Yeah, I think that there's a certain amount of revenge in that, you know. I think you find that with quite a lot of actors, that they were the persecuted at school, so they get to persecute in films, you know.
So how do you think of yourself as dividing your time between more commercial films and more eccentric independent films?
Well, I used to be an independent film snob, you know, up until quite recently, up until I got paid. And what happens is that, first of all, you can pay the rent. You're not worrying about that, which is a, you know, major preoccupation. And then if you do something in the studios, it doesn't really matter if it fails or not. But if you do If you're in a studio film, it's easier to persuade the financiers, the people that are loath to part with their money for an independent film. It's easier to persuade them to do that. You know, they say, well, he was in a studio film, you know, maybe it'll create, you know, some interest is created out there for him, and we'll give you a few grand, you know. Plus, you know, if you can find a good studio film to do, there's nothing wrong with it. But I used to be such a snob, and I think that there's a danger in that.
And you
know, being elitist, you know, I only work in the independent field, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is rubbish. Well, you know, look at what Harvey's done. Harvey has managed to walk that fine line between doing very commercial projects and being able to afford to have a family or whatever, and do things that he is, you know, completely passionate about, that without his name or, you know, would never get made. You know, he can do Sister Act and then he can do Bad Lieutenant.
Did you feel like you learned anything that you could use yourself by watching Harvey Keitel perform?
He gets very deeply involved in his characters. He takes everything very personally. I really do think that he takes it home with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I learned that is not a way that I want to go. I love what he does, but I don't think I could live like that. I really don't. I mean, you do take some of it home with you, I suppose. You just, it's by nature, that's what you do. It's the nature of the job, but I couldn't do it all that way. I couldn't. I'd go mad. I'd drive everybody mad around me, too.
So say on Reservoir Dogs, when he was one of the gangsters, what would he take home with him?
Well, I think, the very, very end of the film, when we shot that last scene...
Mm-hmm. You're both dying, you're both bleeding to death and dying.
He got very, very in there. I don't know what he was using to get, what means he was using to get in there, but it was actually quite scary that, you know, how complete he was as the character.
Well, how could you tell that he had done something extreme inside himself?
Well, he'd be weeping for 4 hours after this. We finished the scene, you know. I think that's taking it. Well, that's the thing about the method, is that everybody has their own and that's his. You know, that's how he gets there. I hope that I'll never have to go to that extent to get there. I don't think my personality could deal with it. I don't think my life could deal with it.
No, so like if he'd be weeping after the scene, would you stay away from him, give him
privacy?
No,
I'd be with him. I'd be with him and we'd talk and stuff and, you know. It's the way it is. You do what you do. You know, you do what you need to do to get in there. And it's pretty amazing.
Did you ever go through doubts thinking, oh, I'm not getting deep enough into the character because I'm not taking it home with me, I must be doing something wrong?
No, I never worry about that. Well, I worry on every film that I can't act. I always have that, you know, you turn up on the first day, I don't know what to do. I have no idea how to act. I'm going to be revealed. You know, you forget. It's almost in between films, you forget how to act. You have nightmares about it. But then you get there and you know what to do. It sort of instinct kicks in and you know how to approach it or whatever.
What's one of your nightmares that's really stuck with you?
The nightmare is you walk out on stage and you're in the wrong play.
When you don't know the lines?
You don't know the lines, but you're in the wrong play. You know the lines to the other play, but that's not the theatre it's happening in.
So what play have you wandered into by mistake in your dream?
I think I walked into Hamlet. That's the actor's nightmare. That's my actor's nightmare.
Tim Roth, he stars in the new movie Rob Roy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling there's something right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. Down the stairs, clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from Villard Books, publisher of Wonder Boys, a new novel by Michael Chabon, author of Mysteries of Pittsburgh. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet the director of a controversial German film about the German neo-Nazi movement. The film profiles a leader of the movement whose media savvy and charisma made him particularly dangerous. The neo-Nazi is about to stand trial in Germany, and the film will be used as evidence against him. Also, music critic Milo Miles remembers two influential people in music who were recently murdered. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the director of the controversial German documentary, Profession Neo-Nazi. It profiles a young charismatic leader of the neo-Nazi movement named Uwald Altans. The film has been praised for exposing the new face of Nazism, but it's been criticized for letting Altans' propaganda go unopposed. The film was banned in parts of Germany and seized by police at a screening in Frankfurt. Altans, the neo-Nazi, will soon be tried in Germany on charges of inciting racial hatred and displaying symbols of forbidden organizations. The documentary film will be used as evidence against him. The film will open in New York next month. I asked the director, Winfried Bonnegel, why he chose Altans as the subject of his film.
I think he was, in a way, the most clever, most smart neo-Nazi I've ever seen. At the beginning, I got the idea these people are in a little kind of sick and a little bit weird. But this Bela Ewald Altans, he is really very smart, and he knew exactly how to manipulate young people, and it was very easy for him to manipulate, to use these people, and this was really frightening.
Altans is a pretty charismatic looking in your film. Is that one of the reasons why you chose him?
Yeah, because he's really a part, because he could be really dangerous. Now he couldn't be dangerous anymore because he's in prison and he has even been kicked out by the other neo-Nazis. And at the same time, it came out that he was homosexual, and he led some sort of a double life because he was very well known in the gay scene in Amsterdam, and nobody in Amsterdam knew that he was one of the most important or notorious neo-Nazis, and it changed his whole life. But I think he was really able to manipulate people so easily, and he got a lot of money from supporters from all over the world. And to me, it looked like somebody behind a friendly countenance, and maybe hidden very, very evil intentions. You know? And this was a picture I got. And you don't see that he is really so evil, and this is even more scaring, you know.
So you say he no longer has any power in the neo-Nazi movement.
No.
Why was he thrown out?
I think people are, even especially young people, are aware of the fact that he basically wanted to promote his own career. To him, I think it was more important to make career as a neo-Nazi, to get money from all over the world. And he was not really interested in the movement, not so much as in himself, in his personal career. And this is really strange, you know, that somebody really tries to make a career as a neo-Nazi. That's the reason why I called the movie A Profession Neo-Nazi, because I think he's so narcissistic and egoistic that he even he doesn't really care about the whole movement. It's just a way to promote himself.
There's a scene in the film where Altans is at Auschwitz, which is now a museum, and he walks into the site of the gas chambers, where people are walking around very solemnly, and he starts to make a speech basically about how the Holocaust is a fraud and how there really weren't gas chambers. People were never exterminated at Auschwitz. And then you film the people who were there and the reaction on their faces. And everybody's uncomfortable. Some people are trying to ignore him. One person starts arguing with him. I was wondering how this scene happened in the first place. Did Altans often go to Auschwitz?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Usually he went a couple of times to Auschwitz, and he explained to young people that the whole thing never happened in this way, and he was denying the Holocaust a couple of times before. And I was really shocked in Auschwitz because I couldn't really not believe what he was doing in front of my eyes, and we stopped the whole shooting for... I really wanted to finish with the whole movie. I didn't speak to Altans for 2 days afterwards.
When you did start talking and working on the film again, what did you talk about? Did you talk with Altans about what had happened at Auschwitz?
No, he knew it. He knew it because our relationship was completely different. It changed really in a way that because he told me, I knew that after Auschwitz you wouldn't react completely different. You would react in a different way because nobody can believe that, you know, what I did.
So how was your relationship changed when you started resuming the film?
No, I found him more than disgusting afterwards. At the beginning, I just I thought that he basically that he wanted always to provoke people, and but I never thought that he would go so far in his proposals and in his acting.
One of the scenes in your film is a conversation between Altans and his parents.
Mm-hmm.
And his parents, one of the things they say, I mean, they don't approve of him being a neo-Nazi.
Not at all, yeah.
They're not neo-Nazis themselves.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they say is that as a boy, he was always looking for attention, and the way he would get it would be by acting extremely and doing it in very negative ways.
Right.
How did you get the parents and Altans to agree to speak together about neo-Nazism in front of your camera?
I don't know. It was very difficult. But I told to Altans, you know, without your parents, there will be no movie. You know, I think I can't do a movie without your parents because basically it's very important to know where does he come from, where does this little monster comes from. And in a way, because mostly people talked, you know, neo-Nazis have really, basically, they're coming really from poor parents who have no education and stuff like that. But his parents, you know, are completely different, and it didn't fit with the cliche of the parents of neo-Nazis. And to me, it was very important to show that he really came from a very social background, and to destroy the cliche one more time.
Well, tell us something about his parents. They're middle class.
I would say some kind of social bourgeois. Say both of them are teaching on schools for blind people, disabled people, and they are really very organized in all kind of social things in Germany. So really, it's really the opposite way of what her son is doing, you know.
My guest is Winfried Bonegal, director of Profession Neo-Nazi, a documentary about the neo-Nazi movement. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Winfried Bonegal, director of the German documentary Profession Neo-Nazi. You have an earlier film about Inga Hasselbach, a neo-Nazi who left the movement and went into hiding during the making of your movie, I believe. I mean, you have a book coming out with him that you co-authored with him that'll be published in the States sometime soon.
Mm.
Did you do anything with him that inspired him to leave the neo-Nazi movement?
Yeah, no, I think it's a long process. It's a long evolution because he really was quite different from the others. I knew it. He has something really sensitive, and I think he just got in the wrong direction. And I knew that there was a possibility to get him out, and I tried it for a very long time. And finally, he made up his own decision.
I know one of the things Hasselbalch has said is that when he first read the anti-Holocaust literature, the literature that denies the Holocaust ever happened, he felt he could finally be proud to be a German, that suddenly he was free of all guilt. Yeah. That made me wonder, how much do you think freedom from guilt is a motivator for people who deny, for Germans who deny that the Holocaust happened?
I think this is an important question, because Germans had never a real... Self, really, most of them, during the whole centuries, had problems of identity, because once they are extremely, in a way, before the First World War broke out, they were really proud of being Germany. Afterwards, there was no, people were even felt ashamed to be Germans. They didn't even say ignore. They tried everything to hide their identity. And then the Second World War, it was just the opposite. It's always very extreme with Germans. And this is something really frightening about German mentality. On one hand, they are really extremely more proud than anybody else in the world. And on the other hand, they try to be somebody else. They try, we are the worst, we are really the most horrible people in the whole world. So there is, it has never been really sane in my eyes. Like in some other countries, you know. So I think it's a really, really strange thing. And I think a lot of people have a problem of identity. So they just, especially today, most of the people say they don't feel really comfortable with the fact that they are Germans. And it's very easy to become, in this context, to become a neo-Nazi, because you say, you know, the whole thing was the Holocaust. You know, it never happened. So... in a way, you know, it's too easy. Yeah?
You've been living in Paris for 12 years. Why did you leave Germany?
Basically, I never really felt quite comfortable in Germany, only at the beginning in my young age. But later, I don't know, German mentality is really too strange to me. I enjoy life much more in France or in Italy than in Germany.
I'm wondering if you're... family's life during the war has anything to do with your feelings about Germany? Did you have the urge to ask your parents what they did during the war?
Yeah, of course I did. My mother, she used to live in a small village, and my father was he was sent to Russia. He spent he was a soldier, a normal soldier in the Second World War.
And what were their feelings about the Reich?
About the Reich?
Yeah.
They told me, my father was never, they forced him to go into war. He told me that he lost 14 times his job, because he was never a member of Hitler's party. And my mother was not really important, because she lived really in a small village. Really, she, the first time when she saw a member of Hitler's party, she didn't know what it was. And later... I think in small villages, people, in a way, at that time, you know, there was no television, there was not really, some people even don't had a radio. It was difficult. They didn't have all the information. My father, it was really disgusting for him to go into war, because he told me he had no choice. Whether you go into the war or you will be shot. So he told me that in this way.
After spending so much time with the neo-Nazi movement, filming it for your documentaries, how powerful do you think it is in Germany and internationally?
I think that basically there's another problem, because there are new generations, and a lot of people, they feel completely lost, you know. There's definitely no hope, no future, and they really feel lost, especially in Eastern Germany. Some people say, really feel it, that there is no possible way for them to do a job or to become a normal person. These people are looking for an identity, and they love to be hated in a way. And it's too easy to isolate these young people. There are, of course, a lot of leading figures and neo-Nazis. You will never change their mind and their convictions. But I'm more or less worried about about young people, because I think the societies have really they don't really care about the sort of these young people, and these young people, they react in this way.
Winfried Bonegal is the director of the German documentary Profession Neo-Nazi. It opens in New York May 19th. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. We're going to be hearing today on the 50th anniversary of the death of President Roosevelt. The competition to claim his mantle, both President Clinton and House Speaker Newt Gingrich are giving speeches, Gingrich claiming that his first 100 days compare to the first 100 days of the New Deal.
Robert, you're actually in Chapel Hill, North Carolina this week, reporting on some campus stories. What do you have for today's program?
That's right. We'll be hearing today about two minority groups at the University of North Carolina, black students and conservative students. And we'll also be hearing from the admissions director at Duke University.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Been an unusually tragic year for world musicians. On February 17th, Rachid Baba Ahmed, the most famous producer of Algerian Rai music, was assassinated outside his office, reportedly by members of a militant Islamic group. Then on March 31st, Selena, the brightest young star in the Latino music called Tejano, was shot to death by the president of her fan club during an argument in a Texas hotel. Music critic Milo Miles considers the loss to both fans and communities when an artist's career is cut short.
Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders wrote Back on the Chain Gang as a memorial to a member of her band who died of a drug overdose. In a grim irony, a cover of the song appeared in the last Selena album released in her lifetime. Now it has become her epitaph. And in the most extreme expression of prejudice against art imaginable, the celebrated producer and musician Rashid was executed because his Rai songs were considered an insult to religion. Tejano doesn't do too much for me, and I'm quite fond of pop Rai. But the music doesn't matter so much as the violence visited on a community. 23-year-old Selena had completed her first English-language album and had a good shot at realizing the notorious crossover dreams. She could boast a strong voice, zesty spirit, and she had already won a Grammy. Often a musician's attempt to cross over to a huge audience unfamiliar with his or her work is considered tantamount to compromise and pandering. But especially when the efforts of such a youngster are snuffed out, it's worth reconsidering what prompts such dreams, as much from fans as performers.
No me queda más que perderme en un abismo de tristeza y lágrimas. No me queda más que aguantar bien mi derrota y brindarte felicidad. No me queda más.
Tejano's audience is centered in the southwestern U.S. and northern Mexico, another of the many vast, under-recognized Latino cultures. If Selena had broken through, she wouldn't have had to function as an ambassador for her ethnicity. She would have done it just by being in the spotlight. Sometimes stars grow far away from their beginnings, but nowadays there's no need to obscure them. In a way, Selena's death means her campaign to represent her constituents has been canceled. Their aspirations to visibility goes with her, and because of her solid beginning within the Tejano community, no matter what she would have sung, she would have been one of us to old fans. Ethnic background did not count in the case of producer Rashid. It was his modernism that was exterminated.
We are ورفت عيني يا الله وراني صابر سيلفيك 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 انا نبغيك عيني يا انا نبغيك متمه
ويا ريح.
Along with his brother Fethi, Rashid functioned as the Phil Spector of Rai music. This was an underclass mode originated by fallen women, which brashly celebrated sex, alcohol, and all-night carousing. Rashid got his start in a 60s-style rock band called The Vultures, and he was part of the worldwide movement that seized the power of modern popular culture. Rashid was a master updater, keeping Rai grounded in its rhythmic sources, yet giving it the punch and sleek grace to hold its own in discos. Unlike many people associated with Rai, Rashid had not fled to France because he was loath to abandon his outstanding 24-track studio in Algeria. He made the ultimate sacrifice to keep his business going. It's worth remembering that one excitement of pure popular culture is that it escapes from any official capacity and hits people directly. It celebrates the moment, gives it weight, and in the case of Rai, looks forward and outward. So killing Rashid was a way to kill modernity in Algeria, to assassinate the future. Rashid was silenced at least as much for his prophecy as for his heresy. But no matter how much violence is arrayed against it, tomorrow will always come, and ordinary people everywhere will dance to new champions.
Milo Miles is a music critic based in Cambridge. Selena's album Amor Prohibido is on EMI Latin. Examples of Rashid's production are presented in the collection Rye Rebels on the Earthworks label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Roberta Shurrock, with Nancy Updike, Barbara Bogave, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Our interns are Sienna Chrisman and Zeb Esselstyn. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. An investor group wants to buy Chrysler Corporation. The group's led by investor Kurt Kerkorian and is willing to pay nearly $23 billion for the rest of the shares of the giant car maker that it doesn't own. Kerkorian's Tresinda Corporation already holds 10% of Chrysler stock. The proposed offer would be about 40% above the current value of Chrysler stock. Lincoln Merrihew, an analyst with DRI McGraw-Hill, says the offer to buy Chrysler is significant because it shows how far the carmaker has come.
Several years ago, they were on the edge of bankruptcy, and now they are so valuable a company that someone's willing to put up over $22 billion to try to take it over. I think it speaks volumes for Chrysler's short-term potential, but also for their long-term potential. If someone's going to go and take the entire company over, they have to have a lot of confidence that long-term Chrysler is going to be a key player in the U.S. auto market.
Chrysler says the offer was not solicited. President Clinton is honoring the legacy of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who died in office 50 years ago today. He's in Warm Springs, Georgia, the site of Roosevelt's little White House, where President Roosevelt would often retreat. Mr. Clinton says the 32nd president was a leader who faced both the problems and potential of American society. He compared some of the problems Roosevelt faced with the status of America today.
It is amazing that in America, we could have more than half the people today living on the same or lower incomes than they were enjoying 15 years ago, and still creating the largest number of new jobs and having the largest numbers of millionaires come out of our economy that we have ever known.
President Clinton also drew comparisons between Roosevelt's investment in education with his own support of educational and job training programs. Mr. Clinton berated the Republican majority in Congress for choosing tax cuts over education. The Oregon Court of Appeals has upheld a state law that bans cities and counties from passing anti-gay rights ordinances. Lee Garnett of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
The prohibition was approved by the Oregon legislature in 1993 after sponsors of anti-gay laws shifted their focus from statewide measures to local ordinances. 27 cities and counties in Oregon have ignored the ban and passed anti-gay laws. Marla Ray is a spokeswoman for the Oregon Attorney General's office.
The effect of this opinion means that the ordinances that have been passed locally are without effect and cannot be enforced.
The Oregon Citizens Alliance, a conservative political action group, says it's surprised by the appeals court ruling and will take the issue to the Oregon Supreme Court. The alliance has twice put statewide anti-gay proposals before voters. Both times Oregonians rejected them, most recently in last November's election. For National Public Radio, I'm Lee Garnett in Portland, Oregon.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen more than 9 points to 4,196. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the NASDAQ Composite Index is up nearly 3 points at 827. This is NPR. A human rights group is calling for the creation of an independent commission to investigate the U.S. Border Patrol. A report from Human Rights Watch Americas is accusing some Border Patrol agents of routinely abusing people as they try to enter the U.S. from Mexico. It says neither the Border Patrol nor its parent, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, is working to root out the abusive officers. A spokeswoman for the Justice Department, which oversees both agencies, says officials haven't seen the report, but she rejects charges that such abuse is common. A senior U.S. diplomat has ended 3 days of high-level talks in Turkey. The talks focused on the Turkish government's military campaign against rebel Kurds in northern Iraq. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot ended his talks with Turkish officials without a firm date for a pullout of Turkish troops from northern Iraq. Talbot said Turkish Prime Minister Tansu Çiller and Foreign Minister Erdal Önönü promised him during the talks that the military campaign in Iraq would be limited. Next week, Çiller meets with President Clinton in Washington. 3 weeks ago, more than 30,000 Turkish troops invaded northern Iraq to attack suspected rebel bases of the separatist Kurdish Workers' Party. Since then, France and Germany have demanded an end to the incursion and the withdrawal of all Turkish troops. Meanwhile, at The Hague in the Netherlands, two rival Kurdish exile groups raised the national flag and established a parliament in exile. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
Japanese authorities have arrested the security chief of a religious sect suspected in the nerve gassing of Tokyo's subways. The man is accused of kidnapping another member who'd tried to leave the group. The arrest is seen as a major step in the investigation of the sect. Meanwhile, a former sect member has told a Russian court the group tested an unidentified nerve gas on its Russian followers. A report says the woman testified a gas affecting the nerves was used on her and other members last December. She says many of them were sickened. This is NPR. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Chrysler Corporation says it will study a buyout offer from the automaker's biggest shareholder and a former chairman. Multi-billionaire Kurt Kerkorian and former Chrysler chairman Lee Iacocca are offering the number three automaker nearly $23 billion for the buyout. Chrysler says the proposal from Kerkorian's Tresinda Corporation is unsolicited and says it doesn't have any financing commitments. It's not clear if Chrysler will resist the takeover offer. A Tresinda executive says it never consulted with any banks because it didn't want word of the plan to leak out. President Clinton led a ceremony today marking the 50th anniversary of the death of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The ceremony was in Warm Springs, Georgia. Roosevelt often retreated there to help ease effects from polio. President Clinton was joined by Georgia Governor Zell Miller, who pointed out that Roosevelt faced many difficult situations during his terms and wasn't deterred by attacks from the right or left.
He knew that the troubles of his time would not be solved by an irrelevant debate between right and left, when the choice was more often between right and wrong.
President Clinton used his speech to draw parallels between Roosevelt's administration and his own goals. The government says consumer prices edged up slightly in March. The Labor Department says they rose 0.2%, the smallest increase this year. Officials say a sharp drop in fruit and vegetable prices offset higher prices for airline travel and car loans. A congressional study released today says the Environmental Protection Agency needs to be overhauled to make environmental protection less costly and more efficient. NPR's Philip Davis reports.
The problem, the report says, is that the EPA isn't looking at the big picture, which is to protect the entire environment. Instead, it inefficiently divides environmental protection into areas like air and water and hazardous waste. The year-long study from the National Academy of Public Administration was commissioned by Congress, but it says lawmakers are partly to blame for the EPA's plight, because Congress saddled the EPA with conflicting environmental laws that pull it in too many directions. The EPA's managers come in for their share of criticism, too. EPA has not adopted a clearly defined mission, says the report, that would allow it to set national goals. Once that happens, the study recommends that the EPA needs to step aside and give the states more flexibility and responsibility for meeting those goals. I'm Philip Davis in Washington.
The United States is allowing the wives of two Americans detained in Iraq to visit their husbands. The held Americans, David Daliberti and William Barloon, were arrested by Iraqi guards on March 13th after crossing the border. On Wall Street, preliminary figures show stock prices closed higher. The Dow gained about 11 points to end the day at 4,197. This is NPR. The alleged mastermind of the World Trade Center bombing says such attacks are justified. Ramzi Youssef is quoted in a London-based Arabic paper that the attacks are right because the United States supports Israel. Youssef doesn't say if he'll plead guilty to the bombing charges. He says his primary plan is to prove his case is legally right. Youssef says he doesn't care if he's convicted or not after that. Youssef also suggests the target of the Trade Center bombing was a Zionist official, but he won't give any names. There's been no evidence the bombing 2 years ago was an assassination attempt. About 7,000 residents of Savannah, Georgia, are being asked to voluntarily evacuate an area near where a fire has been burning at a chemical storage site. The blaze has been burning for almost 2 days. Bruce Dorton of Peach State Public Radio reports.
The fire has been burning since Monday night when a series of explosions at the Powell Dufferin Terminal sent huge columns of fire and smoke into the sky. So far, there have been no injuries, although six residents of an apartment complex were hospitalized for smoke inhalation. They were later released. Coast Guard Petty Officer Steve Atkins says the wind is expected to shift in the next 24 hours, and that prompted the voluntary evacuation call.
Because of the chemicals that are burning and then the smoke, anybody with respiratory problems could be affected.
The fire is concentrated around a 220,000-gallon tank filled with crude sulfate turpentine. Because of the forecast wind shift, Georgia Governor Zell Miller has declared the immediate area south of the blaze a disaster area. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
The United Nations reports dozens of Rwandans were murdered last night in refugee camps in Zaire. A spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees says armed men killed at least 28 people and wounded some five dozen others. Most of the victims are from a refugee camp. Gunmen surrounded one camp and opened fire with rifles and grenades. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.